Time Warner Audiobooks presents Along Came a Spider, written by James Patterson and read by Michael Kumpsty and Alton Fitzgerald White.
The Charles Lindbergh farmhouse glowed with bright, orangish lights. It looked like a fiery castle, especially in that gloomy, firewooded region of Jersey. Shreds of misty fog touched the boy as he moved closer and closer to his first moment of real glory, his first kill. It was pitch dark, and the grounds were soggy and muddy and thick with puddles. He had anticipated as much. He wore a size 9 man's work boot. The toe and heel of the boots was stuffed with torn cloth and strips of the Philadelphia Inquirer. He wanted to leave footprints, plenty of footprints. A man's footprints, not the prints of a 12-year-old boy. They would lead from the county highway called the Stoutsburg-Wurtsville Road up to, then back from, the farmhouse. He began to shiver as he reached a stand of pines not 30 yards from the sprawling house. The mansion was just as grand as he'd imagined, 7 bedrooms and 4 baths on the second floor alone. Lucky Lindy and Ann Morrow's place in the country. The boy inched closer and closer toward the dining room window. The most popular and glamorous man in the world was right there, sitting at the table. Charles Lindbergh was tall, elegant, and fabulously golden-haired, with a fair complexion. Lucky Lindy truly seemed above everyone else. So did his wife, Ann Morrow Lindbergh. Ann had short hair. It was curly and black, and it made her skin look chalky white. The light from the candles on the table appeared to be dancing around her. Both of them sat very straight in their chairs. Yes, they certainly looked superior, as if they were God's special gifts to the world. They kept their heads high, delicately eating their food. He strained to see what was on the table. It looked like lamb chops on their perfect china.
"I'll be more famous than either of you pitiful stiffs," the boy finally whispered.
He promised that to himself. The boy retrieved a wooden ladder left near the garage by working men. Holding the ladder tightly against his side, he moved toward a spot just beyond the library window. He climbed silently up to the nursery. Light cast from a hallway lamp illuminated the baby's room. He could see the crib and the snoozing little prince in it. Charles Jr., the most famous child on earth. The boy quietly slid open the window. Then he took another step up the ladder and was inside the nursery. Standing over the crib, he stared at the princeling, curls of golden hair like his father's, but fat. Charles Jr. was gone to fat at only 20 months.
"Well, Daddy's little man, it's our time now," he muttered to himself.
He took a tiny rubber ball with an attached elastic band from his pocket. He quickly slipped the odd-looking loop device over Charles Jr.'s head, just as the small blue eyes opened. As the baby started to cry, the boy plopped the rubber ball right into the little drooly mouth. He reached down into the crib, took baby Lindbergh into his arms, and went swiftly back down the ladder. The boy ran back across the muddy fields with the precious, struggling bundle in his arms and disappeared into the darkness. Less than 2 miles from the farmhouse, he buried the spoiled, rotten Lindbergh baby, buried him alive. That was only the start of things to come. After all, he was only a boy himself. He, not Bruno Richard Hauptmann, was the Lindbergh baby kidnapper. He had done it all by himself.
Early on the morning of December 21st, 1992, I was a picture of contentment on the sun porch of our house on Fifth Street in Washington, D.C. The small, narrow room was cluttered with mildewing winter coats, work boots, and wounded children's toys. I couldn't have cared less. This was home. I was playing Gershwin on our slightly out-of-tune, formerly grand piano. It was just past 5 a.m., The phone jangled in the kitchen. "Nana, can you get that?" I called from the porch. "It's for you. You might as well get it yourself," my testy grandmother called back. I hobbled into the kitchen, sidestepping more toys on morning stiff legs. I was 38 at the time. If I had known I was going to live that long, I would have taken better care of myself. The call turned out to be from my partner in crime, John Sampson. "Morning, Brown Sugar. You up, aren't you?" he said. No other ID was necessary. Sampson and I have been best friends since we were 9 years old. "If I wasn't up, I am now," I said into the phone receiver. "Tell me something good." "There's been another murder. Looks like our boy again. They're waiting on us. Half the free world's there already." "It's too early in the morning to see the meat wagon," I muttered. "Shit. Fuck me." Nana Mama looked up from her steaming tea and runny eggs. She shot me one of her sanctimonious lady of the house looks. She was already dressed for school, where she still does volunteer work at 79. Sampson continued to give me gory details about the day's first homicides.
"Watch your language, Alex," Nana said. "Please watch your language so long as you're planning to live in this house."
"I'll be there in about 10 minutes, I told Sampson. "I own this house," I said to Nana. She groaned as if she were hearing that terrible news for the first time. I had already decided to wear my old Harris tweed jacket. It was a murder day, and that meant I'd be seeing white people. Over the sport coat, I put on my Georgetown warm-up jacket. It goes better with the neighborhood. I kissed my grandmother on the way out the kitchen door. We've done that since I was 8 years old. It's been like that for almost 30 years, ever since Nana Mama first took me in and decided she could make something of me. She made a homicide detective with a doctorate in psychology, who works and lives in the ghettos of Washington, D.C. I am officially a deputy chief of detectives, which, in the words of Shakespeare and Mr. Faulkner, is a lot of sound and fury, signifying nada. The title should make me the number 6 or 7 person in the Washington Police Department. It doesn't. People wait for my appearance at crime scenes in D.C., though, and we always make an appearance. Sampson and I are both physical. We work out at the gym attached to St. Anthony's, St. A's. Together, we weigh about 500 pounds. We can intimidate if we want to. Sometimes it's necessary in our line of work. I'm only 6'3". John is 6'9 and growing. He always wears Wayfarer sunglasses. Sometimes he wears a raggy Kangol hat or a yellow bandana. A trio of D.C. Metro blue and whites were parked helter-skelter in front of 4115 Benning Road. A crime lab van with blackened windows had arrived. So had an EMS ambulance. The row house was dilapidated clapboard, painted a gaudy Caribbean blue. An old Chevette with a broken taped-up side window looked as if it had been abandoned in the driveway.
"Fuck this. Let's go back to bed," Sampson said. "I just remembered what this is going to be like."
We walked toward the murder house. A couple of uniforms had already been inside the house. A nervous neighbor had called the precinct around 4:30. She thought she'd spotted a prowler. The two uniformed patrolmen found 3 bodies inside. When they called it in, they were instructed to wait for the special investigator team, SIT. It's made up of 8 black officers, supposedly slated for better things in the department. The outside door to the kitchen was ajar. I pushed it all the way open. It was pitch black in the house. Eerie. The wind was sucked through the open door, and I could hear something rattling inside.
"We didn't turn on the light, sir," one of the uniforms said from behind me. "You're Dr. Cross, right?"
I nodded. "Was the kitchen door open when you came?" I turned to the patrolman. He was white, baby-faced, growing a little mustache to compensate for it. He was probably 23 or 24, real frightened that morning. I couldn't blame him.
No. No sign of forced entry. It was unlocked, sir."
The patrolman was very nervous.
"It's a real bad mess in there, sir. It's a family."
One of the patrolmen switched on a powerful milled aluminum flashlight, and we all peered inside the kitchen. There was a cheap Formica breakfast table with matching lime-green vinyl chairs. A black Bart Simpson clock was on one wall. Sampson and I hesitated, taking it all in, the way the murderer might have just a few hours earlier. No matter how many times you do this kind of thing, it never gets easier. You don't want to have to go inside.
"They're upstairs,"
the cop with a mustache said. He filled us in on who the victims were. A family named Sanders, 2 women and a small boy. His partner, a short, well-built black man, hadn't said a word yet. His name was Butchie Dykes. He was a sensitive young cop I'd seen around the station. The 4 of us entered the death house together. The 3 bodies were upstairs in the front bedroom, just off the top of the stairs. There was the mother, Jean Pooh Sanders, 32, Even in death, her face was haunting. She had big brown eyes, high cheekbones, full lips that had already turned purplish. Her mouth was stretched open in a scream. Pooh's daughter, Suzette Sanders, 14. She was just a young girl, but had been prettier than her mother. She wore a mauve ribbon in her braided hair and a tiny nose earring to prove she was older than her years. Suzette was gagged with dark blue pantyhose. A baby son, Mustafa Sanders, 3 years old, was lying face up, and his little cheeks seemed stained with tears. The mother and daughter were bound to an imitation brass bedpost. Satin underwear, black and red mesh stockings, and flowery bed sheets had been used to tie them up. I took out the pocket recorder I carry and began to put down my first observations. Homicide cases H234914 through 916. A mother, a teenage daughter, little boy. The women had been slashed with something extremely sharp, a straight razor possibly. Their breasts have been cut off. The breasts are nowhere to be found. The pubic hair of the women has been shaved. There are multiple stab wounds, what the pathologists call patterns of rage. There is a great deal of blood, fecal matter. I believe the two women, both the mother and daughter, were prostitutes. I've seen them around. The little boy's body seems to have been casually tossed aside. Mustafa Sanders has on hand-me-down pajamas that are covered with Care Bears. He is a tiny, incidental pile in the room. I couldn't help grieving as I looked down at the little boy, his sad, lifeless eyes staring up at me. "I don't believe he wanted to kill the boy," I said to Samson. "He or she."
"Or it," Samson shook his head. "I vote for it. It's a thing, Alex. The same thing that did Condon Terrace earlier this week."
Since she had been 3 or 4 years old, Maggie Rose Dunn was always watched by people. At 9, she was used to special attention, to strangers gawking at her. That morning she was being watched, but she didn't know it. This one time, Maggie Rose would have cared. This one time, it mattered very much. Maggie Rose was at Washington Day School in Georgetown, where she was trying to blend in with the other 130 students. At that moment, they were all singing enthusiastically at assembly. Blending in wasn't easy for Maggie Rose, even though she desperately wanted to. She was the 9-year-old daughter of Catherine Rose, after all. Maggie couldn't walk past a mall video store without seeing a picture of her mother. Her mother's movies seemed to be on the tube about every other night. Her mom got nominated for Oscars more often than most actresses got mentioned in People magazine. Because of all that stuff, Maggie Rose tried to disappear into the woodwork a lot. That morning she had on a beat-up Fido Dido sweatshirt with strategic holes front and rear. She picked out grungy, wrinkled Guess jeans. She wore old pink Reebok sneakers and Fido socklets picked out from the bottom of her closet. She purposely hadn't washed her long blonde hair before school. Her mom's eyes had bugged when she'd spotted the get-up, but she let Maggie go to school that way anyway. Her mom was cool. She really understood the tough deal Maggie had to live with. The kids in the crowded assembly, first through sixth grade classes, were singing Fast Car by Tracy Chapman. Before she played the folk rock song on the auditorium's gleaming black Steinway, Ms. Kaminsky had tried to explain the message of it for everybody. "This moving song by a young black woman from Massachusetts is about being dirt poor in the richest country in the world." The kids liked Ms. Kaminsky, so they tried to imagine the plight of the poor and disadvantaged. Since the tuition at Washington Day was $12,000, it took some imagination on their part. The song finished to loud applause and cheers from all the kids at assembly. "Heavy duty," Michael Goldberg muttered. Michael was standing right next to Maggie. He was her best friend in Washington, where she'd moved less than a year ago, coming from L.A. with her parents. Michael was being ironic, of course. As always. That was his East Coast way of dealing with people who weren't as smart as he was, which meant just about everybody. Michael Goldberg was a genuine brainiac, Maggie knew. He was a reader of everything and anything. He'd been a blue baby, though, and he still wasn't big or very strong. That had gotten him the nickname Shrimpy, which kind of brought Michael down off his brainiac pedestal. Maggie and Michael rode to school together most mornings. That morning, they'd come in a real Secret Service town car. Michael's father was the Secretary of the Treasury. As the students filed out of morning assembly, each of them was asked who was picking them up after school. Security was tremendously important at Washington Day. "Mr. Devine," Maggie started to tell the teacher monitor posted at the door from the auditorium. "And Jolly Charlie Chakley," Michael Goldberg finished for her. "Secret Service Detail 19, Lincoln Town Car, license number SC-59, North Exit, Pelham Hall. They're assigned to moi because the Colombian cartel has made death threats against my father." It was noted in the school log for December 21st, M. Goldberg and M.R. Dunn, Secret Service pickup, North Exit, Pelham, at 3. "Come on, Dweebo, Dido!" Michael Goldberg poked Maggie Rose sharply in her ribcage. As they walked out of the assembly hall, the two friends were being watched. Neither of them noticed anything wrong, anything out of the ordinary. They weren't supposed to. At 9 o'clock that morning, Ms. Vivian Kim decided to recreate Watergate in her Washington Day school classroom. She would never forget it. Vivian Kim was smart, pretty, and a stimulating American history teacher. Her class was one of the students' favorites. Twice a week, Ms. Kim acted out a history skit. On this particular morning, Vivian Kim had chosen Watergate. In her third-grade class were Maggie Rose Dunn and Michael Goldberg. During his annual State of the Union message, President Nixon spoke to the entire nation on television, Ms. Kim told the children. "Many people feel that he lied to us. When a high government official lies, he commits a horrible crime. We've put our trust in that person." "Hiss, boo," a couple of kids in the class participated in the lesson. "Boo is absolutely right," she said. "Hiss, too." Anyway, at this moment in our history, Mr. Nixon stood before the nation, before people like you and me. Vivian Kim arranged herself as if she were at a speaking podium. She began to do her version of Richard Nixon for the class. Ms. Kim made her face dark and gloomy. She shook her head from side to side. "I want you to know that I have no intention whatever of ever walking away from the job that the American people elected me to do for the people of the United States." There was a brittle tap-tap-tap on the glass pane of the classroom door. "Yes, who's there?" The glass and polished mahogany door slowly opened. Mr. Sinigi hesitantly, almost shyly, stepped inside. Nearly every child's face in the classroom brightened instantly.
"Anybody home?"
Mr. Sinigi piped in a thin, squeaky voice. The children erupted with laughter.
"Oh, look, everybody's home," he said.
Gary Sinigi taught mathematics and also computer science, which was even more popular than Vivian Kim's class. He was balding with a droopy mustache and English schoolboy glasses. He didn't look like a matinee idol, but he was one at the school. His popularity and the fact that he was a computer wizard had earned him the nickname Mr. Chips. Mr. Sinigi greeted a couple of the students by name as he quickly made his way to Ms. Kim's desk. The two teachers then spoke privately at the front desk. Ms. Kim had her back to the class. She was nodding a lot, not saying much. Finally, Ms. Kim turned to the children. "Maggie Rose and Michael Goldberg, could the two of you please come up front? Bring your things, if you would." Maggie Rose and Michael exchanged puzzled glances. They gathered their belongings and then headed to the front. When they got to the front of the classroom, Mr. Sinigi crouched down to talk privately to Maggie and Michael. "There's a little problem, but it's nothing to worry about." Mr. Sinigi was calm and very gentle with the children. "Everything is basically fine. There's just a little glitch, that's all." "We just received a phone call from the Secret Service," said Ms. Kim. "They've gotten a threat. It concerns both you and Maggie. It's probably a crank call, but we're going to hustle you both home as a precaution." "I'm sure you'll both be back before lunch," Mr. Sinigi added in support.
"What kind of threat?" Maggie Rose asked Mr. Sinigi. "Against Michael's father? Or does it have to do with my mom?"
Mr. Sinigi patted Maggie's arm. "Oh, the usual kind we get now and then. Big talk, no action. Just some jerk looking for attention."
"Then why do we have to go all the way home to Potomac, for crying out loud?" Michael Goldberg grimaced.
"Just to be on the safe side, okay?
I'm not going to have a debate with you, Michael. Are we ready to travel? Mr. Sinigi was nice, but firm. Not really. Michael continued to frown and shake his head. No way, Jose Canseco. No, seriously, Mr. Sinigi, this isn't fair. It isn't right. Why can't the Secret Service come here and stay till school's over? That's not the way they want to do it, Mr. Sinigi said. I don't make up the rules. I guess we're ready, said Maggie. Come on, Michael. The halls outside the classroom were nearly empty and very quiet. A porter, a black man named Emmett Everett, was the only person who saw the trio as they left the school building. Once outside, they hurried across the school's cobblestoned parking lot. Mr. Sinigi led the children to a late-model blue van parked under elm and oak trees. The two of you can jump right in back here. Upsy-daisy, there we go, he said. The teacher helped boost them up and into the back of the van. His eyeglasses kept slipping down his nose. Finally, he just took them off. "You're driving us home?" Michael asked. "I know it's no Mercedes stretch, but it'll have to do, Sir Michael. I'm just following the instructions we got on the phone. I spoke to a Mr. Chakley." "Jolly Charlie," Michael used his nickname for the Secret Service agent. Mr. Sinigi climbed inside the blue van himself. He pulled the sliding door shut with a bang. "Just be a sec. Make a little room for you guys here." He rummaged through cardboard boxes stacked toward the front of the van. The van was a mess. "Sit anywhere, kids." He kept talking while he looked for something. When he turned again, Gary Sinigi was wearing a scary, rubbery-looking black mask. He held some kind of metal implement in front of his chest. It looked like a miniature fire extinguisher, only it was more sci-fi than that. "Mr. Sinigi?" Maggie Rose asked, her voice rising in pitch. She threw her hands in front of her face. "You're frightening us. Stop kidding around." Sinigi was pointing the small metal nozzle right at Maggie Rose and Michael. "What's that thing?" Michael said. "Hey, I give up. Take a whiff, boy genius. You tell me." Sinigi hit them with a blast of chloroform spray. He kept his finger on the trigger for a full 10 seconds. Both children were covered with mist as they collapsed into the back seat of the van. "Out, out, bright lights," Mr. Sinigi said in the quietest, gentlest voice. "Now no one will ever know." That was the beauty of it. No one would ever know the truth. Sinigi climbed into the front and fired up the blue van. As he drove from the parking area, he sang Magic Bus by The Who. He was in an awfully good mood today. He was planning to be America's first serial kidnapper, among other things.
I got an emergency call at the Sanders house at about 10:45. I took the phone from a young, smart SIT detective, Rakeem Powell. "It's a jefe, the chief," Rakeem frowned. "He's concerned." "This is Cross," I said into the Sanders telephone. The mouthpiece smelled of cheap musk perfume. Pooh's or Suzette's fragrance, maybe both of theirs. On a table near the phone were photos of Mustafa in a heart-shaped frame. Made me think of my own two kids.
"This is Chief of Detectives Pittman. What's the situation over there?"
"I think we have a serial killer. Mother, daughter, and a little boy. Second family in less than a week. Electricity was shut off in the house. He likes to work in the dark." I ticked off a few gory details for Pittman. That was usually enough for him.
"You and John Sampson hustle over to Washington Day," Pittman said. "All hell is broken loose here."
The private school surroundings were a little intimidating for Sampson and me. We were two of only a few blacks inside the Washington Day school lobby. I'd heard there were supposed to be African kids, the children of diplomats at the private school, but I didn't see any. Just clusters of shocked teachers, children, parents, police. Two little kids had been kidnapped from one of Washington's most prestigious private schools. A uniform told us we were wanted in the headmaster's office. Chief of Detectives Pittman was there waiting for us.
"Be cool," Sampson advised. "Live to fight another day."
George Pittman usually wears a gray or blue business suit on the job. He favors pinstripe dress shirts and striped silver and blue neckties. He's a Johnson & Murphy shoe and belt man. His gray hair is always slicked back so it fits his bullet head like a tight helmet. He is known as the jefe, the boss of bosses, duce, V. Pitts, Georgie Porgy. I think I know when my trouble with Chief of Detectives Pittman began. It was after the Washington Post ran a story on me in the Sunday magazine section. The piece detailed how I was a psychologist, but working homicide and major crimes in D.C. I had told the reporter why I continued to live in Southeast. It makes me feel good to live where I live. Nobody's going to drive me out of my own house. Actually, I think it was the title chosen for the article that pushed Chief Pittman and some others in the department over the edge. The young journalist had interviewed my grandmother while researching the piece. Nana had been an English teacher, and the impressionable writer ate that up. Nana had proceeded to fill his head with her notion that because black people are basically traditionalists, they would logically be the very last people in the South to give up religion, morals, and even formal manners. She said that I was a true Southern man, having been born in North Carolina. The title of the piece, which ran over my brooding photograph, was The Last Southern Gentleman. The story caused big problems inside our very uptight department. Chief Pittman especially took offense. I gave a 1-2-3 rap on the door of the headmaster's office, and Samson and I walked in. Before I could say a word, Pittman held up his right hand.
"Cross, you just listen to what I have to say," he said as he came over to us. "There's been a kidnapping at this school. It's a major kidnapping."
"That's a real bad thing," I butted in immediately. "Unfortunately, a killer has also struck the Condon Terrace and Langley neighborhoods. The killer's hit 2 times already. 6 people are dead so far. Sampson and I are the senior people on that case. Basically, we're it. I'm apprised of the situation in the Condon and Langley projects. I've already made contingencies."
"It's taken care of," Pittman said.
2 black women had their breasts sliced off this morning. Their pubic hair was shaved while they were tied up in bed. Were you apprised of that?" I asked him. "A 3-year-old boy was murdered in his pajamas." I was shouting. I glanced at Samson and saw him shaking his head. Chief Pittman gestured toward the headmaster's inner office. He wanted the 2 of us inside the room. I shook my head. I wanted to have witnesses when I was around him.
"I know what you're thinking, Cross."
He lowered his voice and spoke very close to my face. "You think I'm out to get you, but I'm not.
I know you're a good cop. I know your heart's usually in the right place."
"No, you don't know what I'm thinking. Here's what I'm thinking. 6 black people are dead already. A crazed homicidal killer is out there. Now 2 white kids have been kidnapped, and that's a horrible thing. Horrible! But I'm already on a fucking case."
Pittman suddenly jabbed his index finger at me. His face was very red. "I decide what cases you're on. I decide. You're experienced as a hostage negotiator. You're a psychologist. We have other people to send into Langley and Condon. Besides, Mayor Monroe has specifically asked for you."
So that was it. Our mayor had intervened.
"What about Samson? At least leave him on the project murders," I said to the chief of detectives. "You got any complaints? Take them up with the mayor. You're both working on this kidnapping. That's all I have to say to you at this time."
Pittman turned his back on us and walked away. We were on the Dunn Goldberg kidnapping case, like it or not.
A gleaming black BMW K1 motorcycle squeezed between the low fieldstone gates of the Washington Day School. The driver was ID'd, then the bike sped down a long narrow road toward a gray cluster of school buildings. It was 11 o'clock. The K1 streaked to 60 in the few seconds it took to get to the administration building. The motorcycle then braked easily and smoothly, barely throwing gravel. The rider slid it in behind a pearl-gray Mercedes stretch limousine with diplomat's plates, DP-101. Still seated on the bike, Jessie Flanagan pulled off a black helmet to reveal longish blonde hair. She looked to be in her late 20s. Actually, she turned 32 that summer. She had come straight to the school from her lake cottage in North Carolina, not to mention her first vacation in 29 months. That latter fact helped to explain her style of dress that morning: the leather bike jacket, the faded black jeans with leg warmers, thick leather belt, the red and black checkered lumberman's shirt, and the worn engineering boots. 2 D.C. policemen rushed up on either side of her.
"It's okay, officers," she said. "Here's my ID."
After eyeing the identification, they backed away quickly and became solicitous. "You can go right in," one of them said. "There's a side door just around those high hedges, Miss Flanagan."
Jesse Flanagan managed a friendly smile for the two harried-looking policemen. I don't exactly look the part today. I know. I was on my vacation. I raced the bike. Jesse Flanagan took the shortcut across a pristine lawn that was lightly coated with frost. She disappeared inside the school's administration building. As she made her way through the front lobby, she wasn't so much looking for familiar faces as the right faces. There were two of them now. Charlie Chakley and Mike Devine, her agents, the two men she had assigned to young Michael Goldberg and also Maggie Rose Dunn, since they traveled back and forth to school together. How could this happen? Her voice was loud. The talk nearby had stopped, and people were staring. She lowered her voice to a whisper as she questioned the agents about what had happened so far. She listened quietly as she let them explain. Apparently, she didn't like what they had to say. "Get the hell out of here," she exploded. "Get out, right now, out of my sight." "There was nothing we could have done," Charlie Chakley tried to protest. "What could we have done?" Then he and Devine skulked away. Those who knew Jesse Flanagan might have understood her emotional reaction. Two children were missing. It had happened on her watch. She was an immediate supervisor of the Secret Service agents who guarded just about everyone other than the president, key cabinet members and their families, about a half dozen senators. She reported to the Secretary of the Treasury himself. She had worked unbelievably hard to get all that trust and responsibility, and she was responsible. 100-hour weeks, no vacation, year after year, no life to speak of. She could hear the upcoming scuttlebutt before it happened. Two of her agents had royally screwed up. There would be an investigation, an old-fashioned witch hunt. Jesse Flanagan was on the hot seat. Since she was the first woman ever to hold her job, the fall, if it came, would be steep, painful, and very public. She finally spotted the one person she'd been looking for in the crowd, and hoping not to find. Secretary of the Treasury Gerald Goldberg had already arrived at his son's school. Standing with the secretary were Mayor Carl Monroe, an FBI special agent she knew named Roger Graham, and two black men she didn't recognize right off. Jesse Flanagan took a deep breath and walked quickly over to Secretary Goldberg and the others. "I'm very sorry, Gerald," she said in a whisper as she arrived. "I'm sure the children will be found." "A teacher," was all Gerald Goldberg could manage. He shook his head of close-cropped white curls. His eyes were wet and shiny. "A teacher, how could this happen?" He was clearly heartbroken.
I was talking to Roger Graham from the FBI when the Secret Service supervisor, Jesse Flanagan, joined our group. She said what she could to comfort Secretary Goldberg. Then the talk quickly turned back to the apparent kidnapping and the next steps to be taken.
"Are we 100% sure it was this math teacher who took the children?" Graham asked the group.
He and I had worked closely together before. Graham was extremely smart and had been a star in the Bureau for years. He co-written a book about busting up organized crime in New Jersey. It had been made into a hit movie. We respected and liked each other, which is rare between the Bureau and local police. I decided to try to answer Roger Graham's question. I'd calmed down enough to talk by then, and I told them what Samson and I had picked up so far. "They definitely left the school grounds together," I said. "A porter saw them. The math teacher, a Mr. Sinigi, went to Miss Kim's class. He lied to her, said there was a telephone threat, and that he was supposed to take the kids to the headmaster's office to be driven home. Said the Secret Service hadn't specified whether the threat involved the boy or girl. He just kept on going with them. The kids trusted him enough to go along."
"How could a potential kidnapper possibly get on the teaching staff of this kind of school?"
"That we don't know yet," I told Graham. "We will soon." Samson and I were finally introduced to Secretary Goldberg by Mayor Monroe. Then the mayor ushered the secretary inside the headmaster's office. Special Agent Graham trailed along. Jesse Flanagan stayed behind. "I've heard about you, Detective Cross, now that I think of it. You're the psychologist. There was an article in the Washington Post," she smiled. I didn't smile back. "You know newspaper articles," I told her. "Usually a pack of half-truths. In that case, definitely some tall tales." "I'm not so sure about that," she said. "Nice to meet you anyway." Then she walked into the office behind Secretary Goldberg, the mayor, and the star FBI agent. Nobody invited me. Nobody invited Samson. Monroe did poke his head out. Stick around, you two. Don't make any waves. We need you here. Samson and I stood around outside the headmaster's office for another 10 minutes. Finally, we left our posts. A little later that morning, Samson and I were lying across the natural pine floor of the day school playroom with a few of the children. We were there with Louisa, Jonathan, Stuart, Mary Berry, and her big sister Bridget. No one had been able to pick these kids up yet, and they were frightened. Also down on the polished wood floor with us was the teacher, Vivian Kim. We wanted to talk to her about Suniji's visit to her class, and Suniji in general.
"We're new kids in your school," Samson joked with the children. "Kids usually take to Samson. He fits into their friendly monster grouping."
"No, you're not,"
said Mary Berry. Samson had gotten her to smile already. "That's right. We're really policemen," I told the kids. "We're here to make sure everybody's okay now. I mean, phew, what a morning."
"Are you a good policeman?"
Jonathan asked me. "Yes, I am. So is my partner here, Detective Samson."
"Do you have any kids?"
Bridget asked me. "I have 2 children," I said, "a boy and a girl."
"And what are their names?"
asked Bridget. "Janelle and Damon," I told her. "Janelle's 4 and Damon's 6.
"What's your wife's name?"
asked Stuart. "I don't have a wife," I told him.
"Are you divorced?"
Mary Berry asked me. Ms. Kim laughed out loud. What a question to ask our nice friend Mary. "Are they going to hurt Maggie Rose and Michael Goldberg?" Jonathan wanted to know. "I hope they won't, Jonathan. I will tell you one thing. Nobody will hurt you. Detective Samson and I are here just to make sure."
"We're tough, in case you couldn't tell," Samson grinned.
The door to the playroom slowly opened. I looked away from the children. It was Mayor Carl Monroe. "You keeping out of trouble, Alex?" Mr. Mayor nodded and smiled as he took in the unusual playroom scene. Monroe was in his mid-40s and ruggedly handsome. He had a full head of hair and a thick black mustache. He looked businesslike in a navy blue suit, white shirt, and bright yellow tie.
"Oh, yeah. I'm just trying to do something worthwhile with my spare time here."
That got a mayoral chuckle. "Come with me, Alex. We've got to talk over a few things." I said goodbye to the kids and Miss Kim and walked with Monroe out of the school building. Maybe I'd find out what was really going on now, and why I was on the kidnapping instead of my homicide cases.
"You come in your own car, Alex?"
Monroe asked as we jogged down the school's front steps.
"Mine and HFC Finances," I said. "We'll take your car. How's the SIT group working out for you? The concept's strong," he said as we continued toward the parking area.
"What exactly is the concept for SIT?" I asked him. Carl Monroe smiled broadly. "The main idea is to make sure that the strongest black men and women in the Metro Police Force rise to the top, not just the ass-kissers." "I think we'd be all right without too much affirmative action," I said. "You heard about the murders in Condon and Langley Terrace?" He nodded, but didn't say anything more about the signature murders. "Mother, daughter, 3-year-old little boy," I persisted. "Nobody gives a shit about them."
"So what's new, Alex? Nobody cared about their lives. Why should anybody care about their deaths?"
We had gotten to my car, a 74 Porsche that has seen much better days. We both got in.
"You know, Alex, Colin Powell is head of the Joint Chiefs now. Louis Sullivan was our Secretary of Health and Human Services. Jesse Jackson helped to get me this job," Monroe said as we got onto Canal Road and headed downtown.
He stared at his reflection in the side window as he talked.
"And now you're helping me," I said, "without even being asked. That's real nice, real thoughtful."
"That's right," he agreed.
"Then help me out here. I want to solve the murders and the projects. I'm sorry as hell about those 2 white children, but their kidnapping won't go wanting for attention or help. Fact is, that's going to be a problem. Too much goddamn help."
"Of course it is. We both know that," Monroe nodded agreement. "Those dumb bastards will be tripping all over one another."
Monroe was quiet for a moment. He spoke again as we turned onto the Whitehurst Freeway.
"This is a tragic, tragic situation we're facing. This kidnapping is also important for us. Whoever solves it will be important. I want you to help solve it, to be a player. I want you to establish a reputation with this case."
"I don't want a reputation," I said flat out to Monroe.
"I know you don't," he said. "And that's one of the reasons you should. I'll tell you something that is the truth. You're smarter than us,
and you are going to be a big deal in the city. Stop being such a stubborn bastard about it. Let the walls come down now. Your idea of being a success isn't mine, I said. Well, I know what's right here, for both of us. You keep me up to date on the progress of this case. You and I are in this one together, Alex. This is a career-making case.
At 10:25, Gary Sinigi turned his van onto an unmarked drive. Less than 50 yards in from the main highway, he couldn't see anything but the dirt road and a mess of overhanging bushes. No one could see his van from the highway. The van bumped along past a ramshackle, faded white farmhouse. The building looked as if it were collapsing right back into its foundation. No more than 40 yards past the house was what remained of an equally run-down storage barn. Sinigi drove the van inside. A black 1985 Saab was parked in the barn. Unlike the rest of the deserted farm, the barn had a lived-in feel. It had a dirt floor. Cheesecloth was taped over 3 broken windows in the hayloft. There were no rusting tractors or other farm machinery. The barn had the smell of damp earth and gasoline. Gary Sinigi pulled 2 Cokes from a cooler on the passenger seat. He polished off both sodas. "Either of you guys want a Coke?" he called out to the drugged, comatose children. "No? Okay, then. But you're going to be real thirsty soon." Gary Sinigi pulled open the van's sliding door. One body at a time, he hauled the children out into the barn. First came Maggie Rose Dunn, then little boy Goldberg. He laid the unconscious boy and girl beside each other on the dirt floor. He undressed each child, leaving them in their underwear. He carefully prepared doses of secobarbital sodium. The dose was somewhere between a sleeping pill and a hospital anesthetic. It would last for about 12 hours. He took out preloaded one-shot needles called Tubex. This was a closed injection system that came prepackaged, complete with dose and needle. He set out 2 tourniquets. He had to be very careful. The exact dosage could be tricky with small children. Next, he pulled the black Saab forward about 2 yards. This move exposed a 5-by-4-foot plot in the floor of the barn. He dug the hole during several previous visits to the deserted farm. Inside the open cavity was a homemade wooden compartment, a kind of shelter. It had its own oxygen tank supply. He placed the Goldberg boy inside the wooden compartment first. Then came Maggie Rose Dunn. He slid the Tubex needles into each child's arm. He was extra careful to give each dose slowly, over a 3-minute period. He checked the breathing of each child. "Sleep tight, my multi-million-dollar babies." Gary Sinigi shut the trapdoor with a bang. Then he buried the wooden compartment under 1/2 foot of fresh soil. Inside the deserted storage barn, in the middle of godforsaken Maryland farm country, just like little Charlie Lindbergh Jr. had been buried 60 years before. No one would find them out here. Not until he wanted them found. If he wanted them found. Gary Sinigi trudged back up the dirt road to what remained of the ancient farmhouse. He wanted to wash up. He also wanted to start to enjoy this a little. He'd even brought a watchman to see himself on TV. News bulletins were flashing on the television screen every 15 minutes or so. Gary Sinigi was right there on the high and mighty tube. So this was fame. This was how fame felt. He liked it a lot. This was what he'd been practicing for all these years. There was only one glitch all afternoon, and that was the press conference given by the FBI. An agent named Roger Graham had spoken, and Agent Graham obviously thought he was hot shit. He wanted some fame for himself.
"You think this is your movie, Graham?"
"Wrong, baby,"
Gary Sinigi shouted at the TV. Sinigi had been prowling around inside the farmhouse for several hours, watching the night slowly fall outside. It was now 7 o'clock, and time to get on with his plan. Sinigi lit one of the white candles he kept in a side pocket of his jacket. Then he made his way to the small bathroom off the kitchen. The room, the whole house, was freezing cold in late December. Gary Sinigi could see his breath wisping out as he set up shop in the bathroom. Fortunately, the abandoned house had well water, which was still running in the bathroom. Very cold water, indeed. Gary Sinigi lit some candles and began to work. It would take him a full half hour before he was through. First, he removed the dark brown, balding half-wig. He'd purchased it 3 years before at a theatrical costume store in New York City. With the glue and other schmutz off, a full head of blonde hair was revealed, long and wavy blonde curls. Away came the thick mustache that Gary Sinigi had worn since the day he'd arrived to interview at the Washington Day School. Then the contact lenses were removed. His eyes changed from green back to chestnut brown. Gary Sinigi left the farmhouse around 11:30 p.m. He walked to a detached garage that was north of the house. In a special place in the garage, very special, he hid $5,000 from his savings, his secret cash, money he'd stolen over the years. Then he headed down to the barn and his car. Once he was inside the barn, he checked on the kids again. So far, so great. The sobs started right up. He drove out to the main road using only the dimmers. When he finally reached the highway, he flicked on the headlights. He still had work to do tonight. FBI Special Agent Roger Graham lived in Manassas Park, midway between Washington and the FBI Academy in Quantico. Graham was tall and physically impressive, with short, sandy brown hair. At a little past one that morning, Graham finally got home. Home was a sprawling colonial on an average street in Manassas Park. The street was deserted. Porch lights glowed down the line of the road, and they were a comforting, friendly sight. Lights appeared in the rearview mirror of Graham's Ford Bronco. A second car had stopped on the street in front of his house, its headlamps gleaming. A man got out and waved a notepad that was clutched in his hand. "Agent Graham? Martin Bayer, New York Times," the man called out as he walked up the driveway. He flashed a press credential. The reporter wore a dark suit, pinstriped shirt, rep tie. He was your basic up-and-coming New York yuppie on assignment. "You've come a long way at this hour for a no-comment, Mr. Bayer." "I'm sorry," Roger Graham said. "I can't give you anything on the kidnapping. Frankly, there isn't anything to give." "One question, and one question only. I understand that you don't have to answer, but it's that important to me. For me to be here at 1 in the morning. "Okay, let's have it. What's your question?" Graham shut the door of his Bronco. He locked up for the night, flipped the car keys, and caught them. "Are all of you this incredibly insipid and stupid?" Gary Sinigi asked him. "That's my question, Graham Cracker." A long, sharp knife flashed forward once, then flashed again. The blade sliced back and forth across Roger Graham's throat. The second slashed his carotid artery. Graham dropped dead in his driveway. Sinigi bent low and slid a single index card into the breast pocket of Agent Graham's white shirt. Then Sinigi drove away from the murder scene.
I was already becoming emotionally involved with the kidnapped children. My sleep was restless and agitated that first night. I woke to find both my kids in bed with me. At some time during the early morning, they must have snuck aboard. It's one of their favorite tricks. Damon and Janelle were fast asleep on top of a patchwork quilt. I had been too wasted to pull it off the bed the night before. Damon is a beautiful little boy of 6 who always reminds me of how special his mother was. He has Maria's eyes. Janny is the other apple of my eye. She's 4, going on 15. She likes to call me Big Daddy. What actually woke me that morning were headlights fanning across the window blinds. I heard a car door bang, and the fast crunch of feet on gravel in the driveway. Careful not to wake the kids, I slipped over to the bedroom window. I peered down on 2 Metro DC patrol cars parked behind the old Porsche in our drive. Samson was heading for the back door to our kitchen. It was 5:20 on the clock next to the bed. Time to go to work. Just before 5 that morning, Samson and I pulled up in front of a crumbling pre-war brownstone in Georgetown, a block west of M Street. We had decided to check out Sinigi's apartment ourselves.
We entered the building and took the narrow winding stairway up. On the second floor, yellow crime scene tape had been placed in a crisscross pattern across the doorway to Suniji's apartment. The scarred wooden door was open. I could see two FBI techies working inside.
"Hey, Pete, what's doing?"
I called inside. I knew one of the FBI techies on the job. Pete Schweitzer. He looked up at the sound of my voice.
"Well, look who's here. Welcome to the inner sanctum. We came over to bother you. See how it's done," Sampson said.
We'd both worked with Pete Schweitzer before, liked and trusted him as much as you could any FBI personnel.
"Come in and make yourselves at home at Casa Suniji. This is my fellow flyshit finder and bagger, Todd Tui. These two are ghouls like us, Toddy. The best," I told Todd Tui.
I had already started to nose around the apartment. The small studio apartment was a mess. There wasn't much furniture, a bare mattress on the floor, an end table and lamp, a sofa that looked as if it had been picked up off the street, but the floor was covered with things.
Wrinkled sheets and towels and underwear were a large part of the general chaos. Two or three loads of laundry were spilled out on the floor. Most of the clutter was books and magazines, though. Several hundred books and at least that many magazines were piled in the single small room.
"Anything interesting so far?" I asked Schweitzer. "You look through his library?"
Schweitzer talked to me without looking up from a pile of books he was dusting.
"Everything is interesting. Check out the books along the wall. Also consider the fact that our fine feathered friend wiped down his whole fucking apartment before he split."
"He'd do a good job? Up to your standards?" I asked.
"Excellent job. I couldn't have done much better myself. We haven't found a partial print anywhere. Not even on any of those goddamn books."
I was crouched near several stacks of the books now. I read the titles on several of the spines. Most of it was nonfiction from the last 5 years or so.
"True crime fan," I said. "Lots and lots of kidnapping stories," Schweitzer said.
He looked up and pointed.
"Right side of the bed, near the reading lamp? That's the kidnapping section."
I walked over and looked at the volumes. Most of the books had been stolen from the library at Georgetown. I figured he must have had an ID to get into the stacks there. Several computer printouts were taped to the bare wall over his private library on kidnapping. I started to read down the lists.
"Aldo Moro, kidnapped in Rome. 5 bodyguards killed during abduction. Moro's body found in a parked car.
Jack Teach, released after payment of $750,000. J. Reginald Murphy, editor of the Atlanta Constitution, released after payment of $700,000. J. Paul Getty III, released in southern Italy after $2.8 million ransom paid. I whistled as I spotted the amounts on his list.
"Come in here for a minute."
Samson was in the bathroom that was off to one side of the tiny studio. The walls were papered with photos from magazines, newspapers, record albums, book jackets. He'd left a final surprise for us. There were no fingerprints, but he had scrawled a message.
Just over the mirror was a typeset headline. "I want to be somebody."
Up on the walls was an exhibition. I saw River Phoenix and Matt Dillon. I recognized Lennon's murderer, Mark David Chapman, and Axl Rose. Pete Rose was up on the wall, too. A New York Times story of the Lindbergh kidnapping. A story about the kidnapping of Samuel Bronfman, the Seagram's heir. I stood in front of the mirror that was over the sink and stared into it, as I knew he had many, many times. What was I supposed to see? What had Gary Suniji seen? This was his picture on the wall. The face in this mirror, I offered a theory to Samson. It's the key picture here, the central one. He wants to be the star of all this. Samson was leaning against a wall of photos and news clippings.
Why no fingerprints, Dr. Freud?
He must know we have his fingerprints on file somewhere. Makes me think he may have been wearing some kind of disguise at the school. Maybe he put on makeup right here before he went off to school. He could be a stage actor. I don't think we've seen his face yet.
Maggie Rose Dunn had awoken from the strangest sleep of her life, horrible and indescribable bad dreams. She felt as if everything around her were moving in slow motion. She was thirsty. She needed to pee awfully bad. Maggie Rose opened her eyes. At least she thought she had opened her eyes, but she couldn't see anything, nothing at all.
"Mommy? Mommy, Mommy!
Maggie finally screamed and couldn't stop screaming. For an hour after that, at least that long, she floated in and out of consciousness. She felt weak all over. She thought about her mom. Did she know Maggie was gone? Was she looking for her now? Maybe someone took her arms and legs off. She couldn't feel them. It must have been long ago. It was black. She must be buried in the ground. She must be rotting and becoming a skeleton. Was that why she couldn't feel her arms and legs? Am I going to be like this forever? She couldn't stand that, and she was crying again. She was so confused, she couldn't think at all. Maggie Rose could open and close her eyes, though. At least she thought she could, but there was just no difference with her eyes open or closed. Everything was darkness, either way. If she did it over and over, open and closed her eyes real fast, she saw color. Now, inside the blackness, she saw streaks and tears of color, mostly red and bright yellow. Maggie wondered if she might be strapped or tied down. Was that what they really did to you inside a casket? Did they strap you down? Why would they do that? To stop you from getting out of the ground? To keep your spirit under the earth forever and ever? Suddenly she remembered something. Mr. Sanigi. A little of the fog that swirled around her cleared away for a second. Mr. Sanigi had taken her out of school. When had it happened? Why? Where was Mr. Sanigi now? And Michael, what had happened to Michael? They had left school together. She moved then, and the most amazing thing happened. She discovered that she could roll herself over. That's what Maggie Rose did. She rolled over and was suddenly up against something. She could feel her whole body again. She still had a body to feel. She was absolutely certain she had her body and that she wasn't a skeleton. And Maggie screamed. She had rolled into someone or something. Someone else was there in the dark with her. Michael? It had to be Michael. Michael? Maggie's voice was so low it was barely a whisper. Michael? Is that you? Whoever it was wouldn't answer. It was more terrifying than being alone. Michael, it's me. Don't be afraid. It's Maggie. Michael, please, wake up. Oh, Michael, please, please, Shrimpy, come on, Michael, talk to me, Shrimpy. It's Dweebo Dido.
The Dunn House was what local real estate mavens might call Luton-style neo-Elizabethan. Neither Samson nor I had seen too many of those in Southeast D.C. Inside, the house had the serenity and diversity I guess might be common among the rich. There were a lot of expensive things. Art deco plaques, oriental screens, a French sundial, a Turkestan rug, what looked like a Chinese or Japanese altar table. At a little past 8, the hostage rescue team was gathered together in a large, exquisitely decorated sitting room. Right away, I sensed something was wrong. Jesse Flanagan from the Secret Service had taken the floor. I remembered her from the morning before at the day school. She stood in front of a working fireplace. The mantel was strung with holly boughs, tiny white lights, and Christmas cards. Jesse Flanagan looked more formal than she had at the school. She wore a loose gray skirt with a black turtleneck sweater and small gold earrings. Sanigi contacted us at midnight last night, then again around 1 o'clock. We didn't expect him to contact us so soon. None of us did, she started things off. The initial phone call was made from the Arlington area. Sanigi made it clear he had nothing to say about the children, except that both Maggie Dunn and Michael Goldberg are doing well. He wouldn't allow us to speak to either of the children, so we don't know that for sure. He sounded lucid and very much in control.
Has a voice tape been analyzed yet? Pittman asked from his seat near the front.
If Samson and I had to be on the outside looking in, it was good to know Pittman was right there with us. Apparently nobody was talking to him either.
It's being done, Flanagan answered the question politely. She gave it just about the attention it deserved, I thought, but she avoided any condescension.
How long was he actually on the line?
The justice lawyer, Richard Galetta, asked next.
Not very long, 34 seconds to be exact, Flanagan answered him with the same efficient courtesy.
He was long gone when we got to the payphone in Arlington. We couldn't get that lucky so soon, she said. Unfortunately, there's more to it than the phone call. Sanigi murdered FBI agent Roger Graham last night. It happened right outside Graham's house in Virginia, in the driveway. It's difficult to shake up an experienced group like the one gathered at the Dunns. The news of Roger Graham's murder did it. He left a very explicit message for us, Flanagan went on. The message was typed on an index card or what looked like a little library card. The message was for all of us. It said, if you work on this case, you're in